Mark, you mentioned that the books that Paul wrote, they're saying shouldn't be in the New Testament. I just wanted to go a little step further and read what books they are. Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, 1st and 2nd Timothy, Titus, and Philemon. The other one they cannot decide whether he wrote or not was Hebrew. So let's say you give Hebrew a half a book. That's 13 and a half books of the New Testament that they do not want in the Bible or in the New Testament. That leaves 13 and a half books that they are saying in there. So they're wanting to get rid of half the New Testament.
Now, Howard, have you heard this from any other source that these are the books?
I've heard that they want to get rid of them.
Mark, is there a way that the list that you read about Al Gore, is there a way that we could get a copy of that list? That I could get a copy of that list of the things?
I don't know where to get this book. I don't know where I got it. I don't think it's published or available anywhere. I can scan that page, I guess, and make it available.
I'd like a copy of that.
You mean the Al Gore thing? Yeah. Of course you could get his book and read it. I'm sure that book is available on the internet.
Mark, one quick way to do stuff like that is just take a picture of it with your phone and then text it to her. It's just quick and easy.
Oh, Mike.
A couple little things I was going to comment on. One of them is Templeton. I don't know if everybody knows, but I sell axes for excuse me. For my work, what I do is sell axes, so I know a lot about them. And the 3 inches or so from the cutting edge of the axe, they temper it. I'm okay. And what tempering basically is they harden the steel, okay? And the reason they harden it is so when you're chopping wood, it holds its edge and stays sharp. And the way they temper it is when they heat up the axe, they stick that 3 inches at the cutting edge into either oil or water, a substance that's colder than the hot metal, and it makes that metal get harder. And so what I'm thinking is when they talk about untempered mortar, in my mind, it would be the mortar never hardened up. So it just stayed soft in the wall. You could walk up with your finger and just gouge it out of there still, So how good is a wall going to hold up if the mortar never got hardened on it? And then one other thing, you talked about how this big move of the churches is to grow the churches and bring more and more people in and stuff, And this is something I've told the group before, but I don't know if everybody that's on here now was on here then to hear it. So I'll say it once more, but back here, I don't know, 30 years ago or whatever it was, there was this big thing called Promise Keepers, and all the men would go to this Promise Keepers, okay? And I'm not casting judgment on Promise Keepers because I've never gone to it, so I don't feel qualified to speak on it. But here's what happened. This guy came back that had gone to Promise Keepers, and he's telling me, man, this year there was 250,000 people there, and next year they're going to have 1.2 million there. And while he's telling me this, it's like I'm hearing it in one ear, and in the other ear, God says to me, I don't count heads, I weigh them. And that just settled it for me right there. You know, God is not so much in growth. You know, he just wants real Christians. He doesn't care if there's, you know, of course he wants more and more of them, but you know what I mean.
Well, I'd like to share my version of untempered mortar. Mike, I think you were right in there, but mine's a little bit opposite, because in the trade, the mortar will sit out for a while and the wind will get at it and it'll become hard and basically unusable. And that's when we'll be hollering for the laborers, get the tempering water. So the mortar at that point, it won't stick to anything. Nothing will bond together with it. It's very weak. It has no strength. It would not support a wall. And if the inspectors found it that way, it would be torn down and have to be rebuilt. So everybody is on the right track as far as what the meaning of it is. I believe we just all have a different interpretation, but anyways.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Jeremy, because I'm sure there's a spiritual aspect to it if we really look into it. But the first thought that came to my mind was, and I because I was a builder all my life, I understand about something hardening up before you get to use it. So that would be, there's a right time for certain things. Like, in other words, the mortar does need to harden up, but it's got to be put in there and packed around the rocks of the wall and everything at the correct time. So when it hardens, it does its job. So I think I'm glad you brought that up. There's some more thinking to that. I can see and understand it.
Mike, you were saying to weigh the people in your interpretation of what you were hearing about numbers. I think in the same way, they measured the temple. It wasn't count the people, but look at the faith them.
Yes, that's right in the same vein of thinking.
Yeah, when I was thinking about, when you were sharing about the conspiracy, there's something that really speak to me about that. It brings forth the spirit of confusion, and we can see it in so many places, like when Korah rose up in the wilderness, and he brought forth not truth about the promised land, and the people were affected of spirit of confusion. They didn't know what to do, and they were confused about these things, and this spirit of confusion, I believe, comes really from that root. We can see it in so many places. Like, I believe Judas Iscariot had the spirit of confusion. When they were breaking bread and drinking the wine, they all took the bread and eat it, and then they took the wine and drink it. But not Judas. He had some confusion in his spirit because he dipped the bread into the wine. He didn't do it in the same way. It was a confusion. Also, when the disciples came together and they wanted to put something in the place of Judas, they started to come together and put up a little game and lottery, and the winner was they were casting part of who was going to take over. But I believe God had already chosen someone that would come instead. He chose Paul. So this things we can see it in so many places. You mentioned Al Gore. He had a really a conspiracy theorist about the climate change. He brought out through the whole world and got rich about it. And he told all the people that they should be aware of it because the sea level would rise about 1 and 1.5 meter. And then he went and bought a house down to the beach. So why was he not following and believing what he was telling people self? It was because he had a spirit of confusion and he cannot see it. And this spirit of confusion also took place in when they were building the Babel, Tower of Babel. God came down and confused them. They could not understand and could not understood one another. And we are living in a time when we see this strong spirit of confusion rising up in a level that we have never seen before. In this time when we see a war rising up between Europe and Russia, it's a spirit of confusion, brethren. The leader, they are confused. They do not understand quite good what they are facing. And they are not in agreement with one another anymore. They are trying to build up an agreement, but they can't. I see in my country here, Norway, through many years, all the places in our society need to have a more money for school, for healthcare system, and things like that. And the government say we cannot find money to do this. We don't have a money to put into this. But when it comes to war, they found the money because they found the money in our pocket. So this is how confusion is. But we need to have a spirit of God to discern this confusion, concern what is right and wrong. And there is a little story about these things that I really love. It cannot leave my mind. It was a story about that one day the lie came to the truth and said, should we go down to the beach and take a bath, swimming? And the truth said, yeah, it would be nice. So they went down to the beach and the truth took the clothes on and jumped into the water. And the lie took the clothes of the truth and could put it on. And it happened like that since. The lie is covered with truth, and the truth is naked. Oh, blessing to you.
You know, Daniel, what you had to say brought a couple of things to my mind. One of them is how strong confusion can be. And I might have this story wrong, but you'll get the main point. I think it was when Gideon, the enemy, there was thousands of them camped down there getting ready to wipe them out, and they had the dream of Gideon rolling down in the barley loaf, you know, and those guys started killing each other. The enemy started killing each other. That's how strong confusion could be. And then the other thing that came to my mind was I saw, you know, I watched Fox News quite a bit, and they had this really good thing on there just the other day. They had like Al Gore and all these weirdo environmentalists, you know. They showed a little clip, boom, 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 like 10 or 12 people and aired what they said. And it was like Al Gore said in 12 years, the earth will no longer exist. And then they showed this next guy that said, you know, the oceans will rise 16 feet in, you know, and showed all these clips, and not one of them have come true to what these guys had said. It was just perfect.
All false prophets. Somebody put on the chat where that verse was about the talent. It's Revelation 16, verse 21. And there fell upon men a great hail out of heaven, every stone about the weight of a talent, and men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, for the plague thereof was exceeding great. Now I looked up how much a talent is. The New Testament talent is supposed to be 130 pounds. The Roman talent, 71 pounds. The Babylonian talent, 66 pounds. Any one of these would do a terrible, terrible lot of damage. If any one of them hit you and you were outdoors, you're finished. If this is natural, okay? There's a spiritual thing here too. I can't figure it out though. I have one more thing here. I'm talking about money. This church growth thing, it's not just about money, it's about big money. Here's what happened here with Rick Warren. Okay, he's the guy that wrote that 40 days of this and 40 days of that. Okay. In 1994, he led the people of Saddleback, that's his big church, in a faith commitment. And by the way, he has these people making covenants. And God doesn't want these kind of covenants to be made. All right, but they made covenants, a commitment, including a one-day cash offering of $1,400,000. Can you imagine passing the plate and getting $1,400,000? And a commitment to give $22 million over the following 36 months. In other words, he wanted to go into some big building program, and he got the people to agree to do it. In 1997, that's 3 years later, using the same program, the people of Saddleback gave $3 million as a one-time offering and pledged to give $31 million over the next 36 months. Big money. And you know, when one man has all that power, what happens? See, these men, they can live on the royalties that they get from all their books and their tapes and their the things that they publish. The fellow in Texas, he gets millions a year. He doesn't even have to take a salary from the church. Brethren, there's something in this that is not of God. I don't mean to sound negative. There's something here that is not right. There's something here that is, man is taking the place of Jesus Christ.
I had an experience in a Nazarene church when I was in my young 30s. We were attending the church, and they were bringing me in as a elder at that point. And we went in with the pastor of the church to pray before the service. And he asked the question, what can we do to get more people to come to our church so we can get more money? Not so we can save them or anything like that. And it just irked me to no end, you know, at that point. Within a short time, I left that church, but.
I can remember when, before we came out of the system, that I was secretary, basically, in a church situation. And you had to give an account. You had to number the people that came. You had to number the people that made a commitment. You had to number the people that gave, and on and on. And it just struck me when the Lord brought to mind that David numbered the people, and God was very upset with that and brought a plague upon the people. So at that point, I told the person that was in charge, minister, pastor, whatever, I can't do this anymore. I cannot do this. I'm out of here. I will not number God's people or give an account to the head up office of what's going on. So I quit.
Speaking of money again, too, a Mormon that I knew many years ago, he told me that every year they have to send a copy of their 1099 to the church. You know what, you know, some of you don't know what the 1099 is. Your income tax statement that you have to file here April 15th every year to tell, you know, how much you owe the government in taxes. 1040. Well, it's all right, read it. 1040, whatever number. You had to send that to the Mormon church, and they would send you a bill, and you had to pay the tithe on the basis of that.
Yeah, I could never understand when I was a young Christian why I should give a tenth to some people that they could go forth in ministry. Because how could I pay someone to do something that was on my own responsibility to do? I was called to bring forth the word of God. And I could not just lay it aside and say, well, I'm going to hire someone to do it. No, it's on our responsibility to do it on our own. But to give of our things, even to give, even if you think about how to give the 10% or something, well, we should start with our time. Give God 10% of our time. It's a good start. And just to make him a part of our life, we could not buy him. It's not possible, but we could invite him into our life. But the main thing is that we could give and give and give and give whatever we want. But in my mind, after I got older, I started to really look into what David is saying in Psalm 23. It's about, he said, my cup overflow. And what does that mean? It means that everything that fills your cup is for you, but that is overflowing out of the cup is for the others. And I believe that is also what we see when Jesus turned himself around and said, who touched me? Because he knew that there was a power that went out of him. So this woman was healed by her faith, but she touched something that belongs to him. But he was going to bring forth what was of overflowing of his life. When Spirit of God moves in our life, he not only he do not only fill us, but he overflow. And this overflowing that is touching the people is making different for them. And that is what I have in my life since he let me see about the 30-fold, 60-fold, and 100-fold. When he asked me, do you want to see this from my side? Because I saw it like my walk to him. I could 30-fold, then 60-fold, and 100-fold. What a great journey to receive all these things on our way to him. And when he said, do you want to see this from my side? I could only say yes. And then he said, when I come into your spirit, I got 30% of you. When I start to flow into your soul, I got 60-fold. When I flow through your spirit, through your soul, into your body, to the person that is standing before you, because I want to save that person, I got 100%. And that is the prosperity of overflowing of God in our life, brethren. When he fills us, it's for us. But the overflowing from our life is for others. So, amen.
Yes, amen. Well, we've had a blessed time today. At least I have. And we will remember Larry and Madeline. I believe the Lord is going to touch them quickly. Let me turn the recording off.